From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Filmmaker Edgar Wright's new music documentary celebrates two musicians whose work he loves, the enigmatic Sparks Brothers. They're a pair of complete originals, and Wright is an original too. His hit movie Baby Driver was based on stuff he made up. And he can't help but wonder why movie studios aren't willing to take just a few more chances on fresh ideas.
I feel like as a sort of film fan, there's been a lot of like, just, I've grown out of franchises because, and no disrespect to the films, I just kind of think, you know, I don't really need to see another X-Men film in my lifetime. I'm good. I don't need one every 2 years. I'm good.
Wright explains how fellow filmmaker Phil Lord inspired him to turn his obsession with the Sparks Brothers into his new documentary. And he talks about losing a gig as the writer and director of Marvel's Ant-Man in 2014. Turns out his much-analyzed tweet of a Buster Keaton photo at that time actually wasn't full of meaning. But first on the news banter, NBC Universal goes for the gold. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So as you know, the Summer Olympics are scheduled to go ahead. And this is despite a problem that is a major one that has been framed in moral terms recently by John Oliver. Let's listen to him explain the problem.
In fact, only 6% of the Japanese population is currently fully vaccinated. And while I don't know what the target percentage should be to safely host the Olympics, I'm pretty sure that right now it should be higher than the number of entries in the Fast and Furious franchise.
So as you also know, Matt, the Fast and Furious franchise is an NBC Universal franchise, and NBC Universal has a huge stake in the Olympics going forward. This is about the NBC Universal and the IOC and their financial imperatives. NBC Uni's streamer Peacock has been a little slow out of the gate, to put it mildly. And so therefore, they have every incentive to go forward with these Olympics. And I'm just going to quote Jimmy Kimmel, who does a performance every year at the upfronts in May. And one of his lines this past year was, NBC is planning to move forward with the Olympics this summer, even if they have to kill every last person in Japan to do it. And I'm sure he said it in a more amusing way. But there are people who seriously, there's a professor, for example, who was quoted in The Hollywood Reporter, who framed this as a moral issue of danger of going forward in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, this is all about money. The IOC needs these games to happen for financial reasons, and NBC needs these games to happen. They have advertising commitments, and most importantly to them, this is the big coming out for the streaming service Peacock. It was supposed to be last summer. They have languished for a year. We learned this past week in a Wall Street Journal article that only 10 million people have signed up and paid for Peacock. They have about 42 million, quote unquote, signups, they say, and there is an ad-driven component to it. But in terms of people who are paying, that's not a lot. And there's speculation that if this doesn't improve, Comcast is going to have to explore buying another streaming service or a company like ViacomCBS that has a streaming service in order to get those numbers up. So putting the Olympics on Peacock, they're going to have some key competitions like gymnastics and swimming, putting that stuff on Peacock is so key to the success of that streaming service because it's a must-watch environment. That's all these companies are looking for. What can we put on streaming that is going to lure people away from the traditional cable bundle and put them into our streaming universe?
Of course, Comcast is in a position of being part of the cable universe as their original business. And there are some who are concerned that the desire to hold on to that conflicts with the need to launch the streaming service. The Wall Street Journal reported recently that an activist fund, Tryon Fund Management, had disclosed a stake in the company last fall. And according to the journal, the hedge fund has raised concerns about having this content and distribution, the cable business and the content business under one roof, and questioned whether it is being aggressive enough in streaming. And you know, those funds can make problems for these companies.
Yeah, and this comes in the wake of AT&T basically looking at that entire strategy and saying it was a mistake. They thought that they could have content and distribution with Time Warner, and they are now spinning that off to Discovery because they realized how expensive it was, and it wasn't that additive to its distribution business.
And they weren't very good at it, yeah.
Right. They also weren't very good at it. And Comcast, I think, has done a better job of integrating those assets within the larger company. And it's been a decade now. You know, Comcast also benefits from the rise in broadband use from streaming because it's not just a cable provider. It also is in that business. So it's not like it's sacrificing one business entirely to go for another, but it's a shift. And it's a shift that all of these companies are now facing because the days of these high margin cable network businesses are coming to an end slowly but surely. And which companies realign themselves for streaming and do it successfully will determine the next 10, 20 years of the media business.
So bringing this back to the Olympics, they're saying, oh, we're going to have social distancing and you should not cheer, but you should clap. There is a question, though, of course, what we've seen with other sports events, and you can address this better than me, Matt, when the crowds are not in the stands or for whatever reason, these events, some of them have not worked out well, these sports events. And that, I think, is a real danger here. You don't want to take something with the luster of the Olympics and damage it by having it not land the way the Olympics are supposed to land.
Well, they don't have much of a choice here because it's either do it this way or don't do it at all. But what we saw last year during the pandemic year is that when sports came back, specifically the NBA, MLB, to a smaller extent, football, games without fans or with extremely limited fans really did not rate as well as traditional games. And that games have rated since fans have come back. I mean, we've seen rebounds in this year's NBA playoffs. We've seen MLB rebounds this summer. You know, people have speculated why. Maybe people were distracted during the pandemic. But I think not having that excitement of the fan base and the event atmosphere really did hurt a lot of these sporting events. And if we're going to go into an Olympics without fans, I think it's going to depress ratings. And that has big implications for NBC.
Yeah, if they have low ratings, they might have to do make goods, which means their revenue from this will not be what they want it to be. I will just say that the IOC is saying that more than 80% of athletes will be vaccinated, that they are going to be all kinds of protocols. But this is an event that is going to bring like 93,000 people from more than 200 countries to a country where 28% of its population is 65 or older. So yeah, you see that this is a fraught situation in many ways. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, a veteran journalist and founding partner of a new media outlet. The new documentary, The Sparks Brothers, goes deep into the enigmatic world of Ron and Russell Male. The two brothers, now in their 70s, make up the quirky band Sparks. Most often, Ron plays keyboard with a deadpan expression, while Russell is the energetic frontman and singer. Among the dozens of people Edgar Wright interviewed for the documentary are Sparks fans Flea of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, actor Jason Schwartzman, and British TV presenter Jonathan Ross.
I remember just seeing them all the time, like, who are those guys?
They are an anomaly.
I don't feel like they purposely have been trying to be mysterious, right?
They don't really look like a band. They do just like people who've been sort of let out for a day.
Over the brothers' 50-year, 25-album career, Sparks has had more commercial success in Europe than the U.S. Some of its fans have assumed the Sparks brothers were British, but they grew up in and around L.A. Listeners to the KCRW show Bookworm may know that the band wrote and performed the show's theme song. The Sparks Brothers is the first documentary from Edgar Wright, the writer-director behind Shaun of the Dead, Baby Driver, and the upcoming thriller Last Night in Soho. Long before Marvel became a cinematic juggernaut, Wright was tapped to write and direct Ant-Man. He ultimately left the project in 2014 when the studio decided to move in a different creative direction. We will talk about that, but when Wright joined us from London, I had to start with a confession. Before watching his movie, I'd never heard of the band Sparks. Is that the end? Are we over before we started here?
No, I don't think you're alone. I mean, that's sort of why I wanted to make the documentary, is I thought that more people should know who they were.
Yeah, you became aware of them when you were like 5 years old?
Yeah, in 1979, when I was already at that age, kind of obsessed with pop music and watching Top of the Pops every week on the BBC. And they just had a really diverting image, because at the time, like, a lot of other bands would be kind of like, you know, happy and smiling. And then Sparks would be a slightly different proposition. where they seem to be staring into your very soul. So at the age of five, I knew there was something about this band that was a bit different.
Thinking about your career and learning about them, thanks to you, you know, as this band went through multiple versions and reinventions and testing the boundaries all the time, and they stick to the vision. And it made me think about you and your career, because do you see these parallels, or do you think, what is this lady talking about?
I mean, my career is no way near as long as Ron and Russell. So,
well, yes, you are much younger. Like, let me stipulate.
But what I mean is that I feel like I haven't had quite as many zigs and zags as they have. But
right,
there are things about their approach to music that I can see in my own work, in terms of, it really just comes down to sort of sticking to your guns. And, you know, artistic integrity is maybe too lofty a word to use. I think it's more just on a gut level. It's like something that you want to do in a way that you see something. And maybe like Sparks are pretty uncompromising in that respect, in terms of like, there's a certain thing they want to do in a certain way they want to do it. And if they can't do that, they'll move on. And people watching the movie, hopefully what they will take away from it is that sticking to your gut and sticking to your creative beliefs is the only way to really push forward. Because the thing is, you could make something that you're really proud of and it not do well. But somehow the worst version of that is to make something you're not proud of and it'll not do well. So I think like what Sparks has sort of done is that they've never like really sold themselves short. It's just they kind of like have to wait for the public to catch up. And I guess there's been times where I've done movies where they haven't done as well as everybody hoped they would. And, you know, if you're proud of the movie itself and you work your socks off promoting it, at a certain point, there's not really much anything else you can do about it. And in some cases, it's just like, well, I guess we wait, you know, like, and see, like, see if it kind of catches on, like, beyond, like, the three-day weekend and stuff. And
right.
And I've had situations like that where that's been a great thing, and things to sort of have a longevity in them.
I think the idea that seemed to connect you guys so much to me was a commitment to originality, which I think you've shown and they show over and over again. And you talk about originality. I'm going to read a quote. You said this, I think, in 2017, and you were talking, I think, about Baby Driver, Get Out, and The Big Sick, which were three movies that had done well. And what you said was, honestly, they just offer something different. Getting an original movie made in this day and age, it seems at least five times harder and maybe more, just because the majority of studio effort is going into existing IP and franchises. And it feels that has only been more so now. I don't know whether you as a filmmaker are sort of managing to dodge and weave that problem that original filmmakers are facing, or whether you're feeling it yourself.
I mean, I've been lucky so far in the sense I've made, like, my next film is an original, like, screenplay and, you know, and a studio are releasing it. So what I always think is the kind of the really short-sighted aspect to it is this idea that, like, it's just an endless recycling of the same IP. But what I think is so odd to me about that is that most of those projects started as original screenplays. And so it's this weird thing to think, well, yeah, okay, so there's like eight Alien movies, but in 1979, Alien was an original screenplay. And in 1977, Star Wars was an original screenplay. And in 1984, Terminator was an original screenplay. So what I don't understand is, why wouldn't you like make one original film for every two IP films? It just makes sense, because one of them is going to hit and provide you, even on a cynical level, even on just a cynical business level, one of those original movies is going to give you your next franchise. So just like thinking about the future, because it is that strange thing that I feel like as a sort of film fan, there's been a lot of like, just, I've grown out of franchises because, and no disrespect to the films, I kind of think, you know, I don't really need to see another X-Men film in my lifetime. I'm good. I don't need one every 2 years. I'm good. Like, and I'm sure though, in 10 years time, somebody will come back with a revisioning of that material and it'll be amazing. But it is that thing where I feel like, I find it strange when films are just on the schedule in terms of like, one of these every 2 years. It's odd. But I just don't understand why you wouldn't invest in original ideas because they may be the next Star Wars.
And they can be actually inexpensive and be very, very profitable, but maybe not on the $1 billion. Or maybe, you know, I mean, some of these movies do. They get $1 billion. And when you've made them for a lot less than 200, 300 million, that would be good, right? I mean, I don't want to beat the, we all know, I think most people know that Ant-Man happened in an earlier, when the vision of the Marvel Universe was being kind of, you came in as it was being invented, and we know what happened there. But is there any world now that intrigues you about that? Or are you just like, you know what, this thing is all of these things, not just Marvel, but, you know, DCU, Marvel, even Star Wars, you know, get too locked into what people think they want them to be, and there's no space to make it different the way the studios are thinking now, at least.
I would never say never. I'd be a fool to kind of say I'd never do a franchise movie. That would be really silly. I think the thing is I'm always looking for is something where I can be in on the ground floor of something, because most of those films that I mentioned earlier are like the first of something. And even I think the thing is what happened with Ant-Man is that when I first developed it, as far back as like, it was way before 2008. It must have been after Shaun of the Dead. So it was between Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz is when it was first sort of developing it. The thing is, by the time it came around to actually filming it, they had very much established the way they were doing things.
Right.
The look, the style, the kind of the continuity. So it was a thing where sort of by the time I was doing it, they had established the way things work. I mean, it was kind of sort of less controversy about it than maybe it might have appeared, in the sense of I sort of got to a breaking point with it where I was thinking, I don't know why I'm doing this anymore if they don't really want my sort of take on things.
Sure.
And ultimately, I don't have any regrets about it because, you know, when people ask me about it, it's very kind of poor form to kind of have sour grapes about something anyway. But so my kind of glass half full approach to it is that I got to cast my friend in the role and he went on to great success with it. And I went on to make my next original movie, which happens to be my biggest hit. So it was kind of like a win-win. And I got screenplay credit. So it's all fine.
You did. I was actually surprised to see that because I had covered it at the time. You intrigued everybody with your mysterious photo and whatever. But
oh, it was like, actually, that was something I really regret posting that, because it was actually the Buster Keaton Appreciation Society who sent it to me. And I just reposted it. And then people took it as me making a comment about Buster Keaton's career of like leaving the studio and going independent, or rather the other way around, being an independent and joining the studio. It's actually Brad Bird that messaged me and said, I don't think you should post that Buster Keaton photo because it says more than you think it does. And I said, oh, the Buster Keaton Appreciation Society just sent me a photo of Buster Keaton with a cornetto and I reposted it. So I wasn't trying to make a grand comment on me being like the new Buster Keaton or something like that. It was, and I quickly deleted it once somebody had pointed out the context.
Yes, I think people took it as deep scholarship and commentary, which is kind of funny when you think about it. The internet, you know.
Sometimes the best policy is not to be on the internet.
Right, frequently, I think. Not that I stay off of it myself.
But I think the thing is that like, if you're given the opportunity as a filmmaker, and I've been very fortunate in the sense of that I have made original movies with studios, you know, Baby Driver and Last Night in Soho being the two most recent examples. If you get that opportunity, you've got to go for it. Like, so because I feel like it's important for the lifeblood of the industry. But talking on a more on a business level, I really believe that like, so you have to make more original movies because you can't just keep in the same death cycles of the same IP forever, because people are going to get bored of them.
Coming up after a short break, Edgar Wright tells us how he came to play a resistance fighter in a Star Wars movie. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to filmmaker Edgar Wright. His newest project, the music documentary The Sparks Brothers, is in theaters now. For many viewers, Wright's film may be their first encounter with Sparks, an enigmatic band with a cult following. Always original, the group has changed its sound and style many, many times over a prolific and still active career. Much like the band he follows in the documentary, Wright is also committed to his creative vision, even when that led to a flop like his 2010 film, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. Just a few years later, he had the biggest hit of his career, Baby Driver in 2017. That same year, Wright also did some work in front of the camera. You have an uncredited appearance as a resistance trooper in The Last Jedi.
Yes, that's true. I mean, Ryan is a good friend of mine, and he was shooting Star Wars in London, and I was in London, and he, you know, you get the call, do you want to be in Star Wars? Like, sure. And then you get the call saying, do you want to be an Imperial or a Rebel? I know they have different names in the new one. It's like new, not New Order. It's the First Order and the Resistance. That's right.
Oh, good.
So I initially said I wanted to be a baddie. I said they've got the better costumes. But then on the day that they were shooting, it's like, oh, we're only doing Resistance today. I said, fine, I'll be a Resistance. So it was, you know, it was a funny couple of hours just being on like with the rest of the Rebels.
That's a franchise. It's problematic, though, I will just note, because, of course, it's caught in that thing between trying to make more original and then the fans start screaming if you change anything. And then if it's, you don't, the other people start screaming that you didn't change anything. And I don't envy anybody trying to figure that out. I'm working my way back to the Sparks documentary, trust me, okay? So, which leads me to Lord and Miller, who are living examples of that, what I was just talking about, because as we all know, they were dismissed off the Han Solo movie because there was that kind of friction. And then, and which is a kind of thing that makes me think of things that you went through and the Sparks also went through in terms of what seems like something great and then isn't. And then Phil Lord is the one who I think inspires you to do the Sparks Brothers movie. See how I did that? I told you I was getting back there.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, I've known Phil and Chris for a long time, and I was in London when all of that went down on that movie, and I invited them to the Baby Driver premiere in London. They said, oh, we can't, we're shooting. And then the next day I got a text saying, you know what, we can make it. And I said to them, I said, and it was the day after the announcement, I said, you guys have, you have to come out. I said, like, take it from me. Somebody who's been through that is like, don't like sit at home and stew, come out. And so they did come out, and it was great, so great to see them that night. And then Phil, yes, he goaded me, not goaded me. He was sort of the one who called me on it, because I guess the way the Sparks documentary came about was that I had been saying aloud to anybody who'd listened that somebody needed to make a documentary about Sparks. I had never had a checklist on my wall that said, and I want to do a music documentary. It was just something that I felt as a fan of the band, I started to get aggrieved on their behalf that they weren't getting the credit they deserve for like such an extraordinary career. And so I would say to anybody who was within earshot, Sparks, somebody should do a documentary about Sparks. Sparks are like the best, most influential band that don't have a documentary about them. I've seen documentaries about other bands that are way less prolific than Sparks, and somebody needs to make a film about Sparks. And at a Sparks gig in 2017, like after that summer, in fact, me and Phil were standing in the balcony of a Sparks gig at the El Rey in Los Angeles. And as I did my spiel about somebody needs to make a Sparks documentary, he said, you should make the Sparks documentary. And I, and really like buoyed by Phil's enthusiasm, I said, yes, I will. Without any idea of who would make the movie and who would finance it, I said, yes, I will make the Sparks documentary. And then during the show, for the next 90 minutes, I just kept thinking about it. And then after the show, I met Ron and Russell backstage, and I told them about it. And then once I'd said it out loud, then it was like a vocal contract I couldn't renege on. I was like, I'm gonna make good on my promise. Because as you see in the film, over the years, they themselves have had several near misses with making movies.
Yes.
And in fact, that sort of forms one of the B plot of the movie, is that with a happy ending, no less, as well, because not only do they have my feature documentary this year, they also have the opening night film at the Cannes Film Festival. So it's a big cinema year for Sparks. It's kind of extraordinary.
That is extraordinary. Then you go up out, I guess, and there is a sort of joyous kid in the candy store feel that you were interviewing, I think, 80 people about these guys.
They had to stop me at 80.
Who's they, actually? How do you set it up that it's going to be a thing with money backing it?
The first person I tell is Naira Park, my longtime producer of like over 20 years. I say, I want to make a documentary about Sparks. She's like, great. But then actually it was MRC who financed Baby Driver, who had just started a non-fiction division. And so they were like, you know, kind of in the wake of Baby Driver being a big hit for them, as well as me. They were very keen. And my sort of pitch was, that it, you're not assuming that anybody is a Sparks fan. The documentary is as much an introduction as it's a celebration. And in a weird way, I'd say the way that you watched it with no previous knowledge of Sparks is a really great way to watch it. I envy anybody who's never heard of them and then watches the movie. So basically, I told Naira, we set it up with MRC. And then in 2018 is when we actually started filming. And it was around the time that I was also writing or had just written the first draft of Last Night in Soho, which had been in development for a long time with Film 4 and then Working Title as well. So I'd written that and I was sort of getting that ready to shoot the next year. And then in the sort of interim, went around the world with Sparks and went to Japan and Mexico and did interviews in London and Los Angeles and New York. Sort of over the space of nearly a year, I guess. I mean, the biggest challenge of it was actually sort of just getting all of those interviewees into the studio in different cities across the world.
Well, I will circle back to the idea that you connect with them in certain ways in your career. I saw that Russell had told my publication, The Hollywood Reporter, we think the sensibility of what Edgar does cinematically, there's a parallel to what Sparks does musically. So they see it too, I guess.
I think if there's a line to draw between the two of us, I think there is something. And it's weird, I'm like, and I don't want to preface this, that I'm not equating myself to Jean-Luc Godard when I say this, but in the documentary, Ron is talking about the French New Wave and he says, oh, you really like the French New Wave and especially a director like Jean-Luc Godard because he could make movies and also comment on making movies at the same time. And then I think what Sparks does in their music a lot, which is really kind of like a magic trick they pull off, is what they do in their song craft and the emotion of the lyrics is like totally sincere, but that doesn't stop them from having fun with the form. So I think sometimes people kind of assume that any humor in music is somehow insincere, but I think like Sparks are sort of deadly serious about it. And I guess in a way, again, I'm equating myself with Sparks and not Jean-Luc Godard, is that like, especially in my comedy films, I've sort of done a similar thing as I've taken a subject matter I really love. So it would be wrong to say, for example, with Shaun of the Dead, that we made that movie because we hate zombie films. No, we made that movie because we love it. But even though we love that genre, will we have fun with the form? Yes. So it's that thing of like being able to do something with total affection and also kind of like play about with it. And in a weird way, that's also how I approached the documentary itself, is that I love Sparks. I'm very passionate about them. And I love music documentaries, but it's not going to stop me from messing around and sort of making fun of the format. So that was sort of the premise, really.
Filmmaker Edgar Wright's newest film is the documentary The Sparks Brothers. Thank you so much for joining us. I learned a lot.
Good. I'm glad.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Paul Smith, who also mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.